Yeah.
Pardon?
Why can't we just...
Well, you go and try and find out. I mean, where will you find out how much capital is necessarily used in producing bread in this country? Well, no, the capitalist isn't interested in doing it. He doesn't produce it. The government isn't interested. The information simply is not there. See, I knew somebody who tried to do it. He was a communist. And he took as his example imperial chemical industries. Well, first of all, imperial chemical industries, like other companies, gives you a very bare annual report which doesn't give you any real details about the different sorts of things that imperial chemicals is producing. Well, to answer Marx's problem, you've got to know how much capital is actually used to produce each separate thing. There's no use taking ICI produce all sorts of things.
Why don't they give it?
Well, why should they? They don't want it. They're not going to... Wait a minute, they're not going to tell you. They're not going to tell their rivals. Oh, but they don't need to. They need to know the profit on ICI as a whole. And if they find some branches is making a loss, they'll do something about it. But they are not interested in telling you, even where they know it themselves, how much capital is used. For example, how are you going to tell how much of the plant of ICI in any given year isn't used at all, been lying idle? How are you going to find out? There's simply no way of doing it. See, I mean, again, you think of bread. How would you find out? And you see, you remember in the case of bread, you've not got to just go to the bakers. You've got to go right back to the farm where the stuff's grown, and the transport, and the mills. And you see, it's the sort of thing that the capitalist isn't interested in, the government's not interested in. So, well, the man who tried to do it just did a lot of guesswork, and you're not going to convince opponents of Marx by doing some guesswork. And I think the thing to do is to say that that the information simply isn't available, like a lot of information isn't available. There is more statistical information available now than there was 20 or 50 years ago, but not this sort of thing. I mean, and I know no way in which you could possibly find it out, because the capitalist himself isn't interested. You've got to remember, you see, when Marx talked about his average rate of profit, he's not talking about what the capitalist calls his rate of profit. Marx gave his own definition of it based on surplus value. How are you going to know, for example, the different rates of exploitation of the workers, not only in different industries and different companies, but even within the same company? There may be some branch of ICI where the workers are exploited more than another. I mean, in Marx's terms, there's no way to find it out. Well, in what way? I mean, there's an article in the SS, what's it, a year ago, on the Green Pound. I mean, this is merely an arrangement between the EEC countries of agricultural production and people here. And I mean, it doesn't affect the labour theory of value. It affects the price. I mean, here you've got a case where under EEC arrangements, you've got the governments of the EEC paying money into, in effect, subsidising agriculture. But you've had that in this country quite apart from EEC. It started in this country in 1940. The government has, say, since 1940, been paying to put bread and various other things on the market below market price. But, I mean, this doesn't affect value. Well, yes, but, I mean, it's nothing to do with Marx's labour theory of value. This is simply an act of a government.
How can value be defined apart from in terms of the labour expended? This needs to be defined in another way. It's not just going to be a tautology.
I don't think... Why not? I mean, you're not confusing it with what Marx called use value, which is simply usefulness. It has nothing to do with...
How is labour theory of value going to be of any use if value cannot be defined in another way?
Well, such as?
Well, apart from... I can't think of one, that's why I'm asking the question. Apart from in terms of the amount of labour used.
Yeah, I mean, if in fact commodities and their exchange do behave in accordance with the labour theory of value, why look for something else? I mean, plenty of people have tried to, by the way, but you see, this is a case in point where I refer to Rees-Mogg. Rees-Mogg's tried to, found they all don't work, and after years of study, comes back and said, look, we can't do without a labour theory of value.
So the labour theory of value doesn't actually refer to any other type of value, it refers to prices,
exchange.
Wait a minute. It refers to the amount of labour socially necessary to produce each commodity. That's what its basis is. But as I have said, it's nothing to do with what Marx called use value, which is merely usefulness, though they've got to be useful. And there is the other thing about it, you see, that Marx pointed out that value, the only way value can express itself is in exchange, as it were. You can't take a single commodity and think of its value. I mean, it's an abstraction and it's of no meaning and no useful to anybody. It's only when the commodities come in the market that the thing begins to be useful. I mean, that's the test of it all. And particularly, of course, when you had a gold standard, when they all expressed themselves in the value of gold by the relative amount of socially necessary labour to produce them. But, I mean, it seems to me that your question really is raising the whole question as to how any economic theory can be proved. And you can't prove economic theories in books. You can only look in the market and say, well, look, certain things happen, like inflation. Does the labour theory of value explain it? Very much indeed, and it is the only one that explains it. Well, I mean, it's a very good starting point. And, I mean, the relative stability of prices among different things. You see, this expert on the radio programme who said gold has no intrinsic value, he will be waking up, you know, from time to time and expecting gold perhaps to fall below the price of coal, an ounce of gold fall below the price of coal, and be astonished if it doesn't happen. Well, you see, no Marxist would be astonished if it doesn't happen, because everybody knows the amount of labour that is required to produce gold. The enormous amount of labour. You know, I don't know what the figures are, but you know, they'll get a ton of ore and get 2 or 3 ounces of gold out of it, this sort of thing. What does?
Gold.
No, gold has very good, had lots of use values.
Jewellery? Teeth?
Gold teeth, yes. And I understand that it's used in a lot of modern electronic processes. There's a steady, big and growing market for gold.
Medicine. Injected.
Oh, Harvey Wilson.
I'd like to come in, you know, on inflation again, and refer you to the commodity, you know, the paper note, the commodity, and the windfall tax that they're going to try and introduce in this country, and which has already been introduced in America.
What tax is this?
Windfall.
Oh, a windfall tax on banks or the oil companies, yes.
Excess profit tax.
Well, that is an intensified, you know, machinery, intensified industry, the paper note one. What do they mean that when they say, you know, for the audience here, what do they mean when they say, you know, that it has only paper note value?
Huh? Well, I don't know they actually use that. I mean, but wait a minute.
Well, the BB company have come down and said that the money, this paper note value is already committed. Huh? It's committed because it's going to be spent, you know, on what you call looking for more oil wells and...
Yeah, but they're not. See, there's nobody can print notes in this country except the Bank of England. There's no use saying that the Shell Company or the BBC or somebody else. No, but it's not what they say. The only people who can print notes are the Bank of England, and they can only do it on government orders. But, in other words, this is the way inflation happens, because the government lets the Bank of England print notes and puts them into circulation. But you see, what has this got to do with taxation? I mean, all kinds of taxation. The capitalist class run the state machine and they have to have an income to run it. They have to raise money in taxation. And now they always, of course, look where they collect their taxes, where the money is. If the oil companies make super profits, the government will step in and take some. If the banks make super profits, they may step in there. But they'll step in wherever there are big profits. But, I mean, that's a separate matter. That's nothing to do with printing paper money.
Yeah, but what I'm suggesting to you is this, you know, the BB company...
Do you mean the BBC?
No, the BP...
Oh, but British Petroleum.
No. They're saying, you see, that the government has no right to tax for it because the unit's already committed.
Well, then, see,
that's all. I'm not...
No, but wait a minute. The BP or Shell or... Anybody else can say what they like. Yeah. They can go to the government and say, you can't tax us. But, I mean, if the government wants to tax us, they'll tax them.
I'd like to make a comment first and then go on with a question. The comment is that what recommends the labour theory of value to me above all, but it seems to me at least that the starting point to this for most people is prices. most people first thought about the idea of value is when they go into a shop and they have to buy something and they realise that the prices differ. This is their first contact with value, because the prices, of course, are ultimately determined approximately by value. And the what recommends it, really, is that the prices that you see in the shop are obviously socially determined prices and values. It's a very much a social question. The fact that these prices differ in the shop, this is something that's been sorted out by a society of human beings, and therefore it seems very logical that we should trace the root of that in some human activity, because it's the humans themselves which were determining these differentiations in value and in price. So therefore it seems completely logical to conclude that these are going to be determined by human activity, by what we have to do in order to get those, produce those values. And that's my comment. My question is that why is it? There seems to be two meanings to the word commodity. In the note in the newspaper, prices are quoted under the heading commodities, and it's usually things like tin copper and so on.
That's
and
right.
It says commodities. It seems to be a slightly different meaning to the word there.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, they're not using them in Marxist sense at all. This is something that has grown up. I mean, no, you've got to... If you're reading Marx, or if you're reading Keynes, for example, you've got to look at the way he uses words and see his own definition. So when you're thinking Marx, you think of the definition he gives. It's got to be useful. It's got to be the product of labour. It's got to be produced for sale. And forget all about this... the one they use in the economic journals, which is main raw materials and things like that. And, by the way, curiously, selectively, some things don't appear in it, but forget it altogether. On this question of value and price, remember, of course, this, that all this idea of value and price belongs to capitalism, nowhere else. I mean, Marx wasn't writing universal economics for all time. As he says in the opening chapter of Capital, in those societies where... capitalism prevails, something like this. Wealth presents itself as an immense accumulation of commodities. It won't exist under socialism. There won't be prices or any of these things, because we're only buying and selling.
Yes, what I want to say, I always remember in Western Australia in the 1930s, gold was then a £3 an ounce, that's Australian pound. Then it went up to £9. And then with a new process, they start to go to the tailoring. Now, to mention what tailoring is in a gold mine, you have the battery. After the ore gone through the battery, and then you get all the crush ore. Anyway, it was highly successful. Now, just a little while ago, on the telly, Nevada, a ghost town. As soon as it went up to $100 an ounce, and then they went into the tailings there then.
Well, of course, you see, this has happened since. Now there isn't any gold standard, and currency... both here and in Australia, isn't tied to gold. Gold is reaching all sorts of prices which are largely speculative. People are getting into gold simply because they're trying to get out of paper, but I noticed the last two of the days have been coming down again. If the paper currencies are stabilised, the price of gold will start coming back to something related to its value. At the moment, of course, it's speculative.
Yeah.
You said that the plot of land where the factory is built on and the implements and the machines affect the price or the value of the commodity. Would the average price of land going up, then would that affect the price of the commodity as well?
Ah, well, no, see, remember this. Marx is dealing with commodities, things that are produced. Land is not a commodity. And I brought this in merely to remind you that while... commodities have a price because they've got a value. There are some things which have a price, but they haven't got any value, and land is one of them. It's a monopoly thing. As has been pointed out in all these controversies, there were, and there probably still are, places in the world where there's land that's not no price at all. Nobody wants it. In the early days in America, of course, land was given away free.
If you were saying that the actual implements and machines add to the price of the...
Ah, well, what the labour... Yes, but if the labour is embodied in it, that's a different matter. You see, a farm, for example, an enormous amount of labour has gone into a farm, hedging and ditching and improving the soil and things like that. That's the putting labour into it. That's another matter. But for this other purpose, you think of land not as a commodity, but as something that... in certain circumstances, you can only get by paying the landlord because you've got a monopoly of it. But it doesn't go that if you merely pay for land, that doesn't go into the labour required to produce a commodity. It's only labour that adds to the value of a commodity. What happens with the price of land, that comes out of the industrial capitalist surplus value. He gets surplus value out of the workers. If he's had to rent land from a landowner, he's got to hand over some of his surplus value to the landowner simply because the landowner owns it. But it doesn't enter into the value of the commodity. It cuts into his profit.
I wonder if you would elaborate on that bit by giving some illustrations of the differences in the rate of surplus value and the rate of profit in relation to constant capital and so on.
Incidentally, something else you have to notice, and Marx usually pointed out, Marx sometimes uses the term rate of profit where he means rate of surplus value and vice versa. But suppose I mentioned two companies, both invested £1 million, and I said one of them, well, I said ultimately, when prices have adjusted themselves, they'll both pay 15%. Well, that is the rate of profit. What Marx meant by the rate of surplus value was this. Suppose that a commodity is produced. I've got this written down. I might as well. Yeah, suppose the a commodity is produced, and to simplify it, we're assuming here that price and value are the same. I mean, assuming that it's a commodity that one worker produces in a week. Suppose the congealed labour in the commodity, that's the labour transferred from the buildings and machinery, the raw materials into the commodity, represent 50 hours labour, and suppose the wage of the worker is 10 hours labour, 20 hours labour, and giving them a price value, you've got £140. Now suppose that the worker goes on and gives another 2 days' labour to the capitalist, worth another £40, then the surplus value in that case is 100%, because the surplus is equal to the worker's wage. That's the rate of surplus value. Where the rate of surplus value is 100%, it means that the worker has given to the capitalist in the form of unpaid labour an amount equal to his own wage. That's rate of surplus value. And of course the degree of the rate of exploitation, Marx called it, and of course it can change. I mean, there's nothing uniform about it. It's sometimes more and sometimes less, and I would say on the whole in this country at the present time it's considerably less than this. That it's the thing is swung in that way. But the rate of profit is what the capitalist finally ends up with, the industrial capitalist in relation to his capital. If he's invested £1 million and he ends up with £100,000 profit, that is 10% on his investment. That's the rate of profit. Though if you had to be a bit on your guard in value, price and profit, because Marx sometimes refers to rate of profit where he means surplus value, he does warn you about it, and it's usually quite clear that he's making a distinction.
Is there any... Since governments have a monopoly on paper knife production... Governments have a monopoly on paper knife production.
Yeah.
Is that why one could say that, in fact, paper notes have no real value?
Well...
in Marxist terms.
No, well, the paper notes are substitutes for... They were originally substitutes for gold, and then... People would say a Bank of England note is as good as gold, and in fact it was better than gold, because since they could always change their Bank of England notes into a fixed weight of gold, people preferred to have Bank of England notes rather than fuss about carrying gold. So then their value was related to gold. Now they're not related to anything, and all the government's concerned about is purchasing power. And the more they print on, the less the purchasing power of each one. But... See, they're not commodities in the ordinary way.
Yes, sorry, this is what I was trying to get.
Yes, they're not.
It was a monopoly, as you were saying. Anything is a monopoly.
Well, yes, but... This is not really a case of a monopoly. This is simply the fact... This is the state machine in operation. That at one time, banks could print their own notes. Well, in the course of the 19th century, the government gradually extinguished this, ended up with the Bank of England having monopoly. They have a monopoly and the government controls it. In some countries, of course, it's done directly by the government. Other times, it's done through a private bank under government control, which is what the Bank of England was in the 19th century. But it's a state operation and it is a monopoly, but it isn't this that explains the falling purchasing power. You see, of course, if it did, it would work in the opposite direction. If a monopoly puts up the price of what the monopolist is selling, then if the printing of notes was a simple monopoly, then the monopoly would enable the seller of notes to put up their purchasing power because it goes down, not up. So it's not really in the sphere of commodity production.
Do any of the visitors here this evening wish to raise a point? There are 9 of them, according to my list. Anyone who's come here for the first time has any questions or anyone else? Yes.
Those are the Scots,
mate.
No, there is a relic of the time when they did have their own note issue, and they are still allowed to issue Scottish Linen Bank. British Linen Bank is one, isn't it? Is there that one? Well, I believe there's still a residue left. And in fact, it's merely an extension of the Bank of England note issue. In other words, they use Bank of England notes as backing for their currency. But, I mean, they can't increase it. And in the course of time, it's gradually been extended. And they do it only through the authority of the Bank of England.
I don't think you've got what I'm trying to say before. Say, battery. Which has been built on land.
Yeah.
For bricks and mortar. That contains socially necessary labour.
But the bricks and mortar do, yes. The buildings do, yes.
Say, for instance, the average price of bricks and mortar went up. Would that affect the price of the commodity which is produced in that factory?
Well, it would affect the price, but you see, you've got to start, I mean, as far as the labour theory of value is concerned, you've got to start from the labour end. The value of a commodity is the amount, the number of hours of socially necessary labour required to produce it. Having got that, I mean, having got, say, to speak, that a particular commodity takes 10 hours as compared with another commodity which takes 20, you then, the capitalist goes in the market and sells his thing, and Marx's second proposition is that the selling price of all commodities is price of production as defined by him, which is cost of production plus average rate of profit. But from the individual capitalist point of view, if he buys bricks and bricks go up, that's going to cut into his profit. That's quite true. But it doesn't affect the amount of labour required to produce the things. I mean, in the same way, that of course, if he found that he had to pay more for wages, that's going to cut into his profit. But it doesn't affect the value of the commodity. It doesn't affect the price of the commodity. See, suppose something's being produced and the workers, just as coming on the market, strike and get an increase in wages, that comes out of the employer's profit. It doesn't affect the price of the thing that's going to be sold or its value.
You happy with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned the rate of profit, and there's a rather cryptic item in the SS this month, a memo to John Milton. It reads, "Nothing is more absurd than to explain a fall in the rate of profit by a rise in the rate of wages. The rate of profit does not fall because labour becomes less productive, but because it becomes more productive." That's from Capital Volume 3.
I don't know what the point that is being referred to there, but of course in the immediate sense, as Marx always pointed out, every rise in wages comes immediately out of profit. But that is dealing probably with the long-term trends in the average rate of profit, is it? I mean, if it's in Volume 3 of Capital, it almost certainly is.
Volume 3.
Well, I mean, I'm proposing to deal with that in some future lecture, because...
That's a piece of direct composition of Capital. We take it much position as one much further.
Oh, it is this question about the labour-intensive and the capital-intensive,
yes.
Is it?
The corollary to it is that with that happening, the tendency is to employ more constant capital.
Mm-hmm.
So that would bring about a falling rate of profit. You can't have labour power in a technical society being more productive without increasing labour-saving machinery, in other words. I mean, that's the corollary to it, really. I mean, people working can't work any faster without mechanical aids or, you know, with a greater productivity.
Right, well, it's 10 to 10, actually, so...
Time to deal with the annual wages or not?
Well, how long would that...
I assume it can take very long.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe if we finish with that.
Should I deal with it then?
Yeah.
Well, the question was raised about the iron law of wages, and I said I would look it up, and it won't be very long. The iron law of wages was the central theme of the economic theory of Ferdinand Lassalle, who was, in effect, the founder of the German Social Democratic Party, and he based it on the theory, the view of Malthus, that a rise of wages leads to an increase of population, and that the consequent greater competition from jobs forces wages down again. Well, it looks, according to Engels, Lassalle got it not direct from Malthus, but via Ricardo, but Engels accuses Lassalle of having misunderstood what Ricardo was saying. But Lassalle set it out, his theory, in what he called an open letter, and I've summarised it as follows. Wages fluctuate about what is required for subsistence and propagation, that's for the worker to live and bring up a family, and cannot for long rise above or fall below this level. If wages do rise above that level, the consequent increase of marriages and births increases the number of workers competing for jobs, which forces wages down again. It follows that the benefits of increased productivity go entirely to the employers. This was an essential part of Lassalle's argument, and his remedy was the formation of workers' productive associations, and he expected the state to help them with guaranteed loans. And you'll find a very good summary of Lassalle's view on the iron law of wages in a book called History of Socialism by Thomas Kirkup. I've got the 1920 edition, and he sets it out very well. Now, Marx, of course, didn't share the Lassalle's view about the iron law of wages. Engels says, and this is a letter to Babel, 18th of March, 1875, that Lassalle had adopted his iron law from Malthus via Ricardo, and that in doing so he had falsified Ricardo. Marx criticised the theory in his critique of the Gotha Programme. If you look at the critique of the Gotha Programme, you'll find Marx has something to say about the iron law of the wages, and he dealt with it fully in Capital, Volume 1, Chapter 25, if you like to look it up. And Marx, as Engels put it, the laws regarding wages are completely very elastic and not at all iron. And you'll find that in Chapter 14 in Value, Price and Profit. Now, there is another theory which is rather like the iron law of wages, and that is the wages fund theory. It bears some resemblance to the iron law. It was set out by John Stuart Mill in his Principles of Political Economy in Book 2, Chapter 11. According to Mill's theory of the wages fund, there is a limited amount of capital available for the employment of workers, so that wages can rise only if the amount of capital increases or the number of workers decreases. In other words, this is the idea, a slightly different form of the iron law. There's only a certain amount of capital available for wages, and it can only be divided among the workers. So the only way in which it can be increased is if the total amount of capital increases for that purpose, or if the number of workers decreases. Mill added that if through higher prices one group of employers pay higher wages, it will have the effect of reducing the real wages of other workers. Now, this you'll see has been coming up again in the last few years in this country. It's a modern version of the wages fund theory. A number of British trade union officials, largely representing low-paid workers and government workers, have put forward a view, which is in fact John Stuart Mill's view on this wages fund theory. They argue that if one group of workers in a strong bargaining position get abnormally large wage increases, this puts up prices and reduces the real wages of workers not in a strong bargaining position. You remember Wilson's crack, that one man's wage increase is another man's price increase. Well, a number of trade union officials in that in industries where particularly government workers have followed this view, because they found in fact that wherever there's been an incomes policy, Labour and Tory governments have always agreed to give more than average increases to the lowest paid workers. But when the question was raised, it was also asked what was the view of the SPGB towards it. Well, definitely SPGB never agreed with the iron law of wages as stated by Lassalle or Malthus or this wages fund theory. They took Marx's view about wages, but at the same time, in the early days of the party, they took a very pessimistic view about trade unions, as of course did Marx. In other words, in the early days of the SPGB, They looked on trade unions as practically useless bodies, as Marx also did in his early days. Here's a quotation from the party's first manifesto. While the employers were numerous and competing, the workers' unions were able to wring advantages from them and make employment a little less like the hellish slavery it had been. But now that growing combinations of the capitalists in every branch of industry has rendered the chances of winning a fight by the old methods exceedingly small, trade unions upon their present basis are little more than benefit societies which save the capitalist class some amount of the rates and taxes they would otherwise have to pay towards the support of their disabled slaves. Now that pessimistic view was in fact based on what had been happening in the early years of the 19th century. Between 1900 and 1904, wages fell by about 4% and prices rose by about 4%, so real wages were falling from 1900 to 1904. And between 1900 and 1910, real wages fell by about 10%. Also, unemployment was rising. Now, in the face of that deteriorating situation, the early members of the party took a very pessimistic view about the use of trade unions and the future of wages, and also the future of unemployment. But you see, it wasn't based on the iron law of wages. It was based on the way capitalism had been going and the way the capitalist class themselves were organising, and on the other side, the bad way the trade unions were organised, so that they had become a little more than benefit societies. Incidentally, of course, the party in the early days also accepted the Kautsky view about the shrinking world market. Well, if you believe in the shrinking world market and employers becoming stronger, of course the prospect for the workers looked very bad. Well, later on, of course, the situation changed and real wages started to rise again. And when they did, in the 30s, with the publication of that pamphlet, Why Capitalism Will Not Collapse, the party, in fact, formally broke away from this rather despairing sort of view it had in the early days. But they never formally accepted the iron law of wages.
But really, this was the idea of under consumptionism, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that still crept in after 1931 to party articles, isn't it?
Yes.
Even recently.